and welcome to Dialect. Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up there in Preston. Radio Verulam and St Albans, and our listeners in Swindon on Swindon FM.
Coming up in the programme,
of course, Albania for long and strong isolation. It reflects this isolation also in art, in the structure of Albanian art. Miss many important periods.
We meet the director of the Museum of Art in Tirana, Albania.
And the general's consensus is that, it happened to us. You've got to stop it.
Yes, coming to a small town near you, join the campaign to stop a giant supermarket taking over Heian Wai, the town that proclaimed itself an independent state, as well as the world's biggest bookshop. And that is near the Welsh border, if you don't know.
So you have to be prepared to wade through a bit of mud. But it's really worth obtaining this because it is incredibly delicious.
Free wild food you can harvest yourself. Chef Gabriella Jackson, recently back from the Heian Wai Festival, gives us another of her culinary tips in the age of austerity. And we've also got June Burrow here to talk about Refugee Week.
We also have Malcolm Grief coming up later on, as per usual, to read another instalment of Lady Stanhope's Travels. We also have poetry from Rosemary Dunn. Tim Burrows is ill this week, he can't be with us, but instead I've dug up a Scouser. He's called Doc Satori, he's a singer-songwriter who's been in Bristol for about 6 years, so he's going to be with us singing a song later on. And Jeff Sparks, not forgetting him of course, he's here with the What's On Guide and the Song of the Week.
I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. It's my pleasure to welcome June Burrow to the studio.
Hello, John.
You're here to talk about Refugee Week. In what capacity are you involved in Refugee Week?
Well, the Peering Centre ran events for Refugee Week from about 2007 right up until last year. So we were very closely involved in Refugee Week all the way through that. And then I became chair of the City of Sanctuary in Bristol and saw the City of Sanctuary movement through to the launch last year on June the 22nd. So it's been very close.
Okay. So is Bristol the only... City of Sanctuary as it stands at the moment?
No, Bristol and Coventry went for City of Sanctuary together and we were the fourth and fifth. I don't know which one was fourth and which one was fifth, but anyway. Yeah. And Sheffield was the first. And there are now about 15 cities around the UK, five of whom are cities of sanctuary and the other 10 of whom are close to being or working on the process.
So what does that practically mean if you are?
Well, it's a staged process. I think the first thing is that to launch as a city of sanctuary, there are criteria of getting the council on board, getting enough organisations in the city working with refugee and asylum seekers to meet the needs of refugee and asylum seekers, which are very specific. And then after that, it's about how do you galvanise the whole city to really take on board how we support and welcome refugee and asylum seekers. And I think it's really important that people really understand that there are differences between migrants and refugees. There's a big grey area where people are ostensibly migrants but are sort of forced to leave home because of the circumstances they're in. But it's a different kind of definition.
There is a particular phrase, economic migrant, that tends to get bandied around, which sounds like a total confusion of two different things.
Well, I think people sometimes go searching in the world for a better life. And I don't think that that actually is hugely much different from someone saying, I'd prefer to go and live in Spain because the sun shines nice. And I'd rather do that and my life will be better. So I think there are lots of reasons why people sometimes move from one place to another to better their life. With refugees and asylum seekers, they are persecuted or their lives are at risk or they have quite often seen members of their family killed in front of them. So it's a very different starting point that actually means they have a trauma that they carry with them, which is of a specific nature. But that's why I say there's a grey area, because if a regime is making people economically poor and they're then searching for another life, you know, are they migrants or are they refugees or asylum seekers? It's quite there is a grey area.
I guess complicated in terms of economic migrant being an odd phrase, because that can refer to a lot of people who actually come from within Europe, where technically you can just go for a job anywhere without happen to have a visa or do anything particularly special.
As can all of us in the UK, you know, in Europe, we all have that choice to be mobile and find the job that
We're talking refugees. Are we talking sort of people who are ostensibly from outside the European Union, from places where their lives are in danger?
There will be refugees sometimes from within Europe. Mm. If someone is persecuted or their life is at risk, then they are going to meet asylum criteria. We had lots of Jewish refugees around the Second World War.
We did indeed, yes.
They were all European, every single one of them, because that's what it was about. So I'm not saying it precludes Europe, but I think because there's more mobility in Europe now than there was then, people are more able to just simply go somewhere else to look for a better life.
What do you think the atmosphere in Bristol was like? Do you live in Bristol? I'm guessing you're
I do. I live in St Paul's in Portland Square, yeah.
Okay. So what do you think the atmosphere was like in Bristol for refugees? Do you think it was tolerant or welcoming? If you see my point.
Well, when I first got involved, I think there were lots of people saying there were individual organisations hugely welcoming, but as a city, as a culture of welcome, that maybe there was more we could do. And I think the launch of City of Sanctuary last year really shifted that. You know, we had the entire civic leadership, members of the public, refugees, all in the council house and walking down the cathedral aisle together. And a statement of Bristol as a city of sanctuary. There's still lots of work to be done, and there always will be. Mm. But there are now organisations who are working to help meet the needs of refugees, and we're looking at how do we get English as a language to actually be taught for people who, you know, if you don't speak the language, it makes life very difficult to develop and integrate and get work.
Do you think certain groups can be more prejudiced than others? For example, a Muslim refugee might be politically more prone to being prejudiced against than somebody from a different religion.
I'm not sure. I mean, for me, I think welcome is very important. The Pirion Centre had one fundamental principle, which was that we took care of everyone who came to the door, regardless of everything.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful in producing an environment where people really meet each other as human beings.
Yeah.
And I think the world we live in is very complex, and the complexities of belief systems and what's right and wrong, we don't all agree. But if we can talk about those differences and understand why we think and believe differently and are tolerant of each other and help live a life that can still accommodate those beliefs without necessarily condemning other people because they don't have it, or saying it's wrong to be other than how I am, then I think we get somewhere where we can understand that people can do things differently.
In Prospect magazine recently, the June 2012 issue, they published the results of a study, and they asked people about their dreams for a better Britain, and asked people sort of, you know, whether they strongly agree, disagree. And some of them are relatively understandable, you know, more meritocratic values, more honest politicians, journalists, steady jobs. But second highest, 40% of people agreed that they wanted fewer immigrants, which goes back to the difference between immigrants and refugees. How does the man in the street really tell the difference? I mean, how do you get across to people how to welcome a refugee if it's difficult for people to know?
Of course it is. If you're walking down the streets, how do you know who anyone is? I mean, you know, we have criminals walking down the street who've murdered people and we don't know. So for me, I think there's a huge amount of misunderstanding about immigration and about refugee and asylum. I personally think that in Bristol, the immigrant population bring a huge diversity. That's what Refugee Week is about. It's about celebrating what people from other countries bring to the diversity of a city where the music we have and the arts we have and the whole cultural kind of energy in Bristol is hugely, hugely, hugely contributed to by people from elsewhere.
Okay, so what in practical terms have you been doing? For example, it's been Refugee Week very recently. So what happened during Refugee Week?
Well, the opening of Refugee Week is at Queen's Square, and it's a big day with lots and lots of bands and music and information tents and people just having a really good day. And that is absolutely about celebrating. It's what the whole of the UK do for Refugee Week, is celebrate through the arts in the main and cooking and food and just the joy of that lovely diversity. Tomorrow we celebrate our first year at the Mansion House, the Lord Mayor's house, for being the first year of City of Sanctuary. On Saturday there's a football tournament which is hugely popular. It's at City Academy and it's from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock on Saturday, and it's hugely well attended, and it's through sport that, you know, people are bringing a way of being together. So it's competitive, but it also brings everybody together. And they enjoy it, and they have a huge amount of fun.
I should point out to listeners, when this broadcast goes out, that will unfortunately have just have happened, and they would have missed that, unfortunately. I'm imagining you've got an incredibly positive response to that. How do you think City of Sanctuaries movement has gone down in other places, for example, you know, Sheffield or somewhere like that?
Very well. I think what it does is it raises awareness. People then actually want to do something, and simple things that people can do, like if you have a spare bedroom, you can give hospitality to an asylum seeker because they have particular issues when they haven't got leave to remain about where do they live, how do they feed. There are simple things that we can do that just say we welcome people. And then I do think at some point people have to kind of also join in and prove that they've got their worth, but they are hugely skilled and very valuable people.
So I guess in brief, I've got to wrap up, but I mean, to somebody listening to this who will be coming to all of this completely fresh, what do you think people could do to sort of reach out to communities who they don't have a lot of contact with?
Okay, they could, well, for refugees and asylum seekers, so they can go to the City of Sanctuary website and actually pledge to support City of Sanctuary. They could go to the Platformer website, which is where all the artists and refugees for the whole of the UK are listed. They can go to events and support those events. They can actually challenge people who are sometimes very limited in their perceptions about what actually an asylum seeker and a refugee
Platformer,
are.
How do you spell?
Platformer is Platforma, and it's a website that is really full of events and all sorts of arts.
Okay, and the City of Sanctuary website will also be very easy to find.
It's www.cityofsanctuary.org/Bristol is the Bristol page.
Okay.
It's another national website.
And I think this is particularly important at a time like this, given that, unfortunately, the EDL are planning, the English Defence League are planning on marching through Bristol, of all places, on Saturday the 15th of July. So I think hopefully this message will be, you know, will continue to go out up to that event and through it and show them all that they're wrong.
There's a huge amount of education, I think, about the reality of immigration as well as refugees. It's a big debate, and I think people often make statements and decisions which are not really understanding of the entire complexity.
Well, we must get you back again, Jim Burrow, but for the meantime, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John.
Our next feature is from Albania, the National Museum of Art in Tirana, to be specific, the capital city, where art is blossoming after 40 years of closure from the outside world under the dictatorship of Enver Hoxha.
Of art. I've come to meet the director of the museum. Hello.
My name is Rubens Shima, and I am the director of the National Art Gallery in Tirana, Albania.
How is art in Albania? Are you looking to expand it into the European scene?
The question is in two parts. First, how is art in Albania? We have a particular art history here. The secular painting in Albania starts in the end of 19th century. We are still in the time where Albanians were not a country, but only an entity into the Ottoman Empire. And then, in 1912, we have the independence of the Albania. And also, we have the art history that start from this time, or we have started from Byzantium, post-Byzantium, and then secular painting. All art in Albania, its history is 120 years old. Let's say it is divided in two main periods, before the war and then during the social realism, during the communism that we call the art of social realism. Of course, Albania, for a long and strong isolation, it reflects this isolation also in art. In the structure of Albanian art, miss many important periods. I'm speaking for those earliest tendencies of modernism that were present in the Europe. In Albania, we don't have it, like Impressionism, Futurism, Cubism, Surrealism, Dadaism, and so on. Because here, for 50 years, the social realism art always has been propaganda for the communists. Now, the second period, I consider it the second period after the big political change of 90s, it is a different story. There are a lot of information, literature also coming mostly from the West, different tendencies of movement in world art, European art, and there is a young artist generation who are successfully exhibit here in the museum, in the National Gallery, but also in other local galleries here, but also they are exhibiting successfully in different European countries.
Which leads to the second part of my question. Yeah. How do you envisage Albania entering into the European art scene?
I think that our particular history, it is quite interesting to be represented for the foreign audience in Europe or in the world. I think that our past is a very interesting material to work with. Also, Albanian artists mostly nowadays work with our past and repropose this past in a global context. Those are some of the concepts of different exhibitions that we organize out of Albania, but also in Albania. And this find it with a lot of interest for foreign audiences to see a different country, to see a country which has been for such a long time under isolation. And what is a risk in this process is that always they prefer to see Albania always with an exotic eye. This is a risk or a permanent risk that Albanian art is exposed to.
Have you made any links with European art galleries?
We organize different exhibitions here. We also organize interesting exhibitions in different museums in Europe, mostly in Italy, also in Beijing, in China. But in this summer, we would have a very interesting exhibition of British artists, which is the collection of the British Council. Important artists, young British artist movement, like Sarah Lucas, Damien Hirst, also will have beautiful painting for Peter Doig, and it will be a very interesting exhibition, and those exhibition myself and Albanians here consider a very important exhibition because they are a possibility to understand and to know those artists and also different culture.
Do you have a website if people are interested in the exhibition that's coming up?
Yes, we have a website. That is gka.lo, I'm saying in Albanian, but I'll give it here. gkl@al.al.
Thank you very much to Anthony Page for that feature on Albania and what it was like for the ordinary people living under Hoxha's dictatorship. We hear how one family was split under the regime.
My grandfather went in the USA during the communism period, the time of communism that was here in Albania. He left 4 children and the wife, and they couldn't communicate at the first time because was not allowed. After they wrote to each other, when my father was grown up, he was called as an enemy of the city, my father also, and also his brothers and his sisters, because of their father left the country. My father couldn't go to the college, couldn't get college, even though he was a brilliant student. Because there were this part of people that left Albania, they had no privilege and they were very limited. like to leave the country or the city, they have to get a special order from the police station. My father didn't see his father. He died before the communism was down. When he died, the people that were living close to him asked for my father and asked the government to give the permission, but they didn't give. So, no, he wasn't alive to leave Albania.
What would have happened if your grandfather had come back to Albania?
He at least would go directly to the prison because he was a traitor of the country, so he would go directly to the prison or executed without trial or something.
We lifted off the intro so that it would be a nice surprise for you, but here is a feature recorded by Anthea Page at the Ashburton Blues Festival with a band called the Groove-O-Matics. But first, here's the Commitments.
That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour, when there's no one else around. I'm gonna take you, girl, and hold you, and do all the things I told you in the midnight hour.
Midnight hour.
I'm gonna wait till the stars come out and see that twinkle in your eye. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour.
Midnight hour.
That's when my love begins to shine. You are the only girl I know. And real life won't last me so in the midnight.
My name is John Whitehill of the Groove-O-Matics, lead guitar player. Band has been formed about a year ago. Basically, the idea was just to get together with a bunch of friends and play the music we loved. Because I used to play professionally with a band called Paul Am the King Snakes. And I effectively retired because I'd had enough. Then I started to miss it. So I got this bunch of lads together and it was sounding really great, so I decided to go back on the road. I was with Paul Lamb for 25 years or something. And, but I love the band I've got now. They have a great singer, sax player, harp player, Mick Cantwell. I used to be more very authentic 50s style. It's always been blues, like. Now it's more 60s type blues, more Texas, Chicago, whereas it used to be very swing orientated. As any fan of Paul Lamb will remember, you know. I was all very swingy, and it changes as good as the rest, basically. Just because I've been doing the other stuff for 25 years, you know, I mean, I love the blues, but you've got to vary it now and again just to give yourself a bit of a breather. But just starting to play around the country, virtually retired, and was just playing odd local things. Now I want to travel again, and I think I've got the right band, so hopefully we'll be travelling a lot more. I'm a bit out of touch. I'm not sure what venues are in Bristol now. I used to play there with Paul, but we definitely used to do Bristol. I mean, I'm going back. It's 9 years since I left Paul. So it's more than 10 years since, probably 10, 15 years since I played there. I can't remember. You know, when you're dealing with Paul, we did about 200 gigs a year, so you all mix into one after a while.
All right, I'm Mick Cantwell. I'm the singer with John. Oh, I've been around a bit, you know. I've done a variety of genres over the years. Swing, jazz, obviously a lot of blues. Up till last year, I was in a rock tribute band impersonating Paul Rodgers. And I've got another act that does a sort of a generic sort of a show with a lot of Tom Jones and Chris Rea and stuff like that.
That's my name's Barry Race. A fantastic experience. Started about 2 years ago. We started as a trio when Johnny came back up north, and we developed in it with having Mick on board. And the band's developed, and it's just it's a very solid background, but with John's experience and everybody else, because we've all played in various blues bands throughout the northeast in various places. So we've got a lot of experience, but band's sounding great. With the blues guys, I mean, I did a gig years and years ago with John, with Phil Guy and various other people, but most of the people in the northeast, you know, Ray Stubbs played with the Bone Shakers. There's several different bands that I play with. Everybody plays blues a little more in the northeast. I've kind of played with, to be honest. But, you know, playing with John's just, it's been great for all of us, you know. We enjoy doing it. But it sounds good as a band. That's the whole thing, you know. That's the whole thing. It's just, it grooves. That's what it's supposed to do. But we do like travelling when we get the opportunity to do as far as we can, you know. And this is the second time. We did this as a trio 2 years ago. And it was great, but now we've got Mick on board. We're so much looking forward to come back here, because it's just a great crowd here, you know. It really is. They're really nice people. Very friendly.
Thank you very much to the Groove-O-Matics and to Anthea Page for recording that.
Our next feature is about another small town under threat from a giant supermarket. It's a similar theme to that of Camelford in Devon, where a school site was developed by Asda, and a historic building, in the way of the development, mysteriously was burnt down one night. So let's hear now what's happening on Hay on Wye.
Hello, I'm Bill Richards.
Tell us what's happening here.
Well, there is a school which is due for demolition and revival, and the site of the school is proposed to be sold to developers for the building of a supermarket, and the school will be rebuilt with the aid of the money from the supermarket on playing fields which currently exist. So we have a situation where we would have school on playing fields, so we'd have less playing fields. We'd have a supermarket near to the car park, which would ruin the trading of the town. And all in all, it would destroy the atmosphere of Hay, which is, to say, unique. Everywhere thinks that it's unique, but Hay does have a very natural atmosphere, an interesting atmosphere, which would be destroyed if the local trader's business was ruined by the opening of a large supermarket.
So this isn't a news story, is it? It's happening to our small towns all over Britain. How can we stop it?
Well, what we're trying to do is to persuade. We have what is called Plan B, which has worked out that a new school could be built on the existing school premises without actually closing the existing school. Problem is, how does one raise the money in order to build that school? Because the whole point being that if the site was sold to a supermarket, this would raise X million quid, which would enable the council to build a school on the playing fields. What we're looking for as well is a school to be built that will have a community centre in it, all on the same site. So it really does act as a centre for the town, that is near the centre of the town, without destroying the existing natural atmosphere of the town.
So how many people in the town are for this scheme of yours?
There are many people for the scheme. There are a few who are against it, because there is an appeal of having a supermarket with cheap food. There is an existing supermarket, it's a co-op, but it's about 300-400 yards away from the centre of the town, which for some people is quite a long walk.
What's your petition website?
The petition website, it's planbforhay.org.
Well, you're very well organised. How many people have signed the petition so far?
I can't tell you.
Many?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, we have hardly any resistance to it. And what is interesting is that now it's the Hay Festival, people who are coming in from many other towns, and the general's consensus is that, well, it happened to us. You've got to stop it.
That was Anthea Page with petitioners on Hay on Wye. Don't forget, you can support the anti-supermarket campaign by joining the online petition. And who knows, if this bid fails, it may turn the tide against further assaults on small towns by the giant supermarkets.
Now, in this age of austerity, we might all be on the lookout for cheaper food, but what better than free food and fresh air? Now is the month to enjoy nature's pantry.
Hello, I'm Gabby. I live in Devon, and Devon, we grow, or don't consciously grow, but a lot grows on our south coast. Samphire. Now, a lot of people don't know what samphire is. I'll spell it for you. It's S-A-M-P-H-I-R-E. And samphire is also known as sea asparagus. And you eat it the same way. It's just dipped into boiling water and then eaten with melted butter. It grows only on salt marshes. So you have to be prepared to wade through a bit of mud. But it's really worth obtaining this, because it is incredibly delicious. Samphire, you'll find it on menus of very smart, expensive restaurants. It's not often available commercially except through fishmongers during sort of June, July and maybe a bit of August, but here in Devon I know lots of lovely secret places where I can get the samphire. Cooking samphire, very, very easy. You just bring it home, you give it a good wash because it's probably got quite a lot of mud attached to it, and just pop it into boiling water for like sort of 2 or 3 minutes and then eat it with melted butter. And it's a many-fingered green plant, and you put it in your mouth and then you sort of pull it, and there are sort of tendons in the middle. You've got to be careful when picking it though, because you want the samphire to grow back every year. So take a pair of scissors. If you know where to find samphire, then take a pair of scissors and cut the samphire rather than putting it up by its roots, because we want the stocks of samphire to continue. There's also something called rock samphire, which grows up on the cliffs. And some people pickle. They make a pickle out of rock samphire. It doesn't appeal to me, because I think the sea vegetable, samphire, is the really delicious vegetable. It's really worth trying out. And you can have a lovely day out. You can go out for the day. You can locate your samphire and then take it home. And then a few minutes later, you can have this absolute feast. Quite good for you. There are a lot of minerals in samphire.
That was Gabby Jackson talking about samphire found on a beach near you.
Malcolm Grieve reads another chapter from The Travels of Lady Hester Stanhope from the book by Virginia Childs. This week, Merrion travels to Palmyra.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, by Virginia Childs. On the morning of 14th January, Merrion and his guide Hassan left Machanar's encampment with the relief. Since they were fairly near to Palmyra, they decided to try and get there. Not only did Hassan's family live there, but Merrion wanted to make sure there was suitable housing for Lady Hester. They struck out in a northeasterly direction, and after a successful escape from a small band of rather incompetent would-be robbers, were soon within sight of Gebel el Abiad, the white mountain that guards Palmyra. They crossed the vast salt-encrusted plain of El Mezar, which is bounded by Gebel el Abiad on the left and Mount Ayan on the right, and entered a narrow valley enclosed by small hills. Here they found the ancient reservoir that trapped the fountainhead of water that used to supply Palmyra. They then followed the route of the league-long aqueduct to the Valley of the Tombs, just outside the city. By this time it was night, and the doctor found it an awesome experience to thread his way by moonlight past the ancient monuments to long-dead Palmyrans. The valley was a mile long, and as he and Hassan approached the angle in the hills from which the panorama of Palmyra would unfold before them, Merrion was taut with excitement, and it seemed almost perfect that his first sight of the fabled city was to be by moonlight. Poor Merrion. It was a huge anticlimax. The moonlight was not strong enough, and he could see nothing. His feelings of disappointment were almost overwhelming, but sensibly he reminded himself that he was tired, hungry, and thirsty. and that things would seem better in the morning. He and Hassan made their disconsolate way down to the longed-for but still unseen ruins, and finding Hassan's relatives, settled down within a mean mud hut for the night. It is impossible to tell from the records whether or not Hester had asked Marion to go to Palmyra on this trip. She had often sent Marion ahead of her to arrange accommodation in new places, but her impending visit to Palmyra was so important to her that it seems strange that she would run the risk of tarnishing the glamour of her trip by sending Marion there first. By now the journey to Palmyra had assumed giant proportions. She had written letters to Crawford Bruce, General Oakes, and many others about her intentions. Hundreds of people had become involved in her plans and preparations, and she was sufficiently determined to go to wait for months in Khamar under conditions of extreme discomfort. Unlikely as it seems, however, I think that Hester had indeed requested Marion to go to Palmyra to arrange suitable housing for her. She probably rationalised it on two counts. The salient differences between her proposed trip and any that had gone before were that, firstly, she was a European woman going where none had gone before, and secondly, that she intended to go not as a thief in the night, as all the others had gone, but with the highest possible profile. Another indisputable point was that Marion was only able to go safely into the desert by using Hester's name. Using these criteria, it seems likely that she did not perceive Marion's trip as undermining the importance of her own. She would still be the first European woman to go to Palmyra. The triumph would still be hers. Marion stayed in Palmyra for 6 days, and surprisingly perhaps was disappointed in what he saw. There certainly were the massive columns and stately temples he had expected, but to him they didn't look as impressive as those in the plates that Wood and Dawkins had produced. Situated as it is at the foot of huge craggy mountains, he felt the city correspondingly diminished. He could see that the vast pillars carved from a single block of Egyptian granite were impressive, but to him they dwindled to the size of tapers when seen from the distance of a few hundred yards. The glorious golden ochre of the stone was another dissatisfaction. "The face of the soil is precisely the same hue," he complained. "Tints must be opposed to set each other off." Perhaps he had been expecting too much. There was nothing to please him. He organised some houses to be prepared for Lady Hester, made one or two excursions, and returned to Khamar. Lady Hester had been worried about Marion, for he had been gone longer than she expected, so she was glad to see his safe return. When he had recovered from his journey, he told her all about his experiences with Machanar and of his stay in Palmyra. She made no comment. Perhaps, after all, she was a little jealous. She had been having a very dull time. The weather was still appalling, and there had only been one European visitor to Hamar all winter. The only other company she and Michael had had was that of some dreary, deposed governors who had been exiled to Hamar. Michael had got hold of a copy of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which he had been trying to read, whilst Hester divided her time between letter writing and keeping everybody's spirits up. She had become keenly interested in desert politics, and had several orderly Arabs who kept her well informed. "I receive dispatches every 2 to 3 days," she wrote to Henry Williams Wynne in a marvellous rambling letter dated 15th January, "giving me an account of what is going forward in the desert, of what battles have been fought, and with what tribes war has been declared, etc., etc." Good news for the Syrians was that Mecca had been recaptured from Ibn Saud's followers, the Wahhabis, who had been forced to retreat to their own capital of Daria. More sombre tidings had come from the coast, however. Plague had come to Sidon, Acre and Tyre, and judging from past experience, would spread inexorably inland along the caravan routes. Hester was unconcerned by threats of plague. She wanted news of her friends in England. "Do tell me how you find Ebrington. What is the matter with him, and why so out of spirits? Dear creature that he is, when everybody loves him, how can he be unhappy? When you write to me, fill a whole page about him, for he writes me little squeezy letters, and says very little always about himself. Tell me how dear old Sligo is," she continued, "and what is Taylor doing?" She also wrote revealingly of Syria. "There are some men of great talents in this country, but generally speaking the greatest rascals upon the face of the earth. But you know I like rascals better than fools. The latter do about the same portion of mischief in the world, and bore one to death besides. In a letter to Mrs. Fernandez, the woman with whom she had stayed in Malta, she wrote amusingly of how Marion had become almost more Arabic than the Arabs. "Oh, I forgot to tell you that the gentlemen all have long beards. And the doctor is such a quiz you can have no idea of. His head shaved and a pigtail coming out of the crown a yard long. Copper-coloured sheepskin and a pipe 6 feet long, never out of his mouth. He never stands 2 minutes and squats about all over the house," she continued with glee. "When in the air, pulls a mat after him to sit down upon, washes his hands every 5 minutes, and always eats with his fingers." Even allowing for the undoubted exaggeration, it seems that Marion had adopted Arabic ways with enthusiasm.
That was Lady Hester's Travels from the book by Virginia Childs, read by Malcolm Grieve. We're joined in the studio by Rosemary Dunn. Hello.
Hello there.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm fine. And in keeping with all the football that's on at the moment.
Yes, that is progressing.
Yes.
Yes.
And then I'm going to be doing a poem about David Beckham.
Fabulous.
Okay, so this poem I wrote after watching a football match and he kicked a brilliant goal from the corner.
He done a goal?
He did, he did. This was in his early, some years ago. And it was just so brilliant that I couldn't stop thinking about it. And everywhere I went, people were talking about David Beckham. So it was a short step to imagine that he was following me around everywhere. So this is called I'm Being Followed by David Beckham. Oh, and I should say that although I think David Beckham is a fine specimen of a man, I find him strangely unsexy.
It's the voice.
David Beckham follows me. He hangs around the supermarket, urging me to buy organic. It's good, it's fresh. I can't do this accent. All that malarkey. And did you see me on TV last Friday? David Beckham stalking me. I saw him down the pub. Would you like to see my snaps of Brooklyn or Romeo? Victoria sends her love. He flashes me his very best shy and boyish grin, then offers, apropos nothing much, I kicked the ball. It went right in. David Beckham sits atop my television, one leg outstretched, the other dangled. Could you shift a little to the left, Dave? I say. You're blocking the parts in ER where that lovelorn nurse gets shot. I hate this bit, says David. It makes me want to cry. I'm a sensitive, new football kind of guy who doesn't mind telling all the world that I love my kids and I got the girl. David Beckham tucks me up in bed at night. Sweet dreams, don't let the bed bugs bite. Next he slowly disappears, first his body, then his ears, until his smile is all that's left, a Cheshire cat with football legs. I whisper to him, good night, Dave. That's all. There's nothing bestial. He merely is a top-rate friend who's strangely somewhat asexual.
Thank you very much, Rosemary.
Thank you.
That was very informative.
It is my pleasure to welcome Doc Story to the studio. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So tell us a little bit about yourself as a singer-songwriter.
Oh, well, I've been playing for quite a long time, many years now. I used to be in bands and stuff when I still lived in the Northwest. And just when I moved south, I just decided to buy an acoustic guitar and just go it alone instead of starting all again.
How long have you been in Bristol?
I've been in Bristol for nearly 6 years now, and I was in Exeter for 8 years before that. So
okay.
I've been doing this for quite a while, yeah.
What sort of stuff do you like to sing about? What are your inspirations?
Songs of mental decay. I mean, the song I've just done, How Hard It Is about being around somebody who's losing touch with reality and you're standing to one side and can do very little about it. Or I'll sing political songs. I've got slightly political things, or about lost and yearning like anybody else.
Okay, so this is how hard it is.
How hard it is, yeah.
Like this, I find a fear for you, for you. I see a figure in the dark. I think straight away of you. Hanging on to something though, you don't know where it'll take you. You're fighting for an inner peace you'll never know. And all the time I wonder how you'll make it from day. Once upon a time I could keep up with you, with you. But when it just fell apart, I felt I was dead. In your own way, but there's more going on in the fortress that you call your mind than I'll ever know. I never came close to it, and I regret that for the rest days. 'Cause I know how hard you try to keep it all from overpowering you. And you know how hard it is. So it will be. Here comes another one, a bullet in the heart for you. You're strong enough to take it. I know that's still true.
Well, thank you very much for that. That was How Hard It Is by Dr. Tory, who's still here. Do you play around out in public an awful lot?
Yeah, a little less these days, but I do tend to play at places like The Mother's Ruin and Mr. Wolf's. Lots of the place called Under the Stars, which is an excellent open mic on the third Sunday of every month.
Third Sunday of every month?
Yeah, which is one coming up this coming Sunday, I think.
Tim Burrows, for eagle-eared listeners, also does poetry and sings.
It's a mixture of poetry and song, and it's a decent night, yeah.
Do you have anything recorded or anything like online?
I have some songs on YouTube. It's youtube.com/Doxatory1. I've got 6 songs on there.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is my pleasure to welcome Jeff Sparks to the studio, all dressed in black from head to foot.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 29th of June, Dire Straits Tribute Act at Dire Straits. We'll be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 29th of June, Jason Ringenberg, the leader of Jason and the Scorchers, will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Hailstorm. This group formed in Pennsylvania, USA in 1998, and in their career they have released 2 studio albums and 5 EPs. This is from the EP titled Hello, It's Ms. Hyde, which was released in 2012, and the song is titled Rock Show. That was Hailstorm with Rock Show from the EP Hello, It's Ms. Hyde. For more information, you can check out www.hailstormrocks.com. Into Saturday 30th of June, Reckless Guitar Promotions and New Revolution Music Promotions presents A Reckless Revolution, featuring acts such as Roots of Reason, Running from Zombies, It Sucks, Parasite, The Hotel Ambush, Black Wolf, Made to Waste, Texas Flood, and Alien Stash Tin, who will have Steve Pond of Inner City Unit and Crankshaft fame performing with them. All this entertainment will be at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol, and entry is £4 on the door and doors open at 2 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to my studio guest, June Burrow. And remember, Bristol is a city of sanctuary, so you can look that up on the internet and find out what that's about, and also look at the platform or website. Features were by Anthea Page, and Malcolm Grieve read an excerpt from Lady Hester's Travels from the book by Virginia Childs. Thank you also for poetry by Rosemary Dunn, and we also had Dr. Tory coming in to sing us a song.
Jeff Sparks was back in the studio with his What Song Guide. We had studio engineering from Michael Noyce with Ian Hodgkinson, and the producer was Anthea Page. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Colan. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
Don't you think it's time?